his wife, I was going to say, can we go wrong? Do we work these guys as a plate?
No, we don't work them.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. And it is Tuesday, April the 1st, 2003, so I want to make sure that everyone gives the truth today. I don't want to hear any stories like I just told. And I'm going to open up as a subcommittee and the subcommittee of one until the rest of our committee gets here. And at this time, Greg, I suppose you're coming back. Is that correct?
We're going to do the agency
response. Oh, we are going to do that first.
Let's just get it up.
Mike, come on up.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from ODOT. You should have before you a list of answers to questions from March 31st. Looks like this, and if everybody has that in front of them, we'll just briefly go through it, and if you have any follow-up questions, we can hit those now. The first one was relating to track miles that have been replaced or improved, and the rail division is tracking down that number. We don't have it this morning yet, but we'll get that back to you. There are two questions from Senator Morris relating to operations and administration and rail planning and projects and operations as to how those, what those totals relate to and how, what was total to get to that amount. And that's listed as Attachment A and Attachment B. And they simply lay out the budget categories that total into those two program areas. And if you or the Senator have a question at some other point about those totals, we'd be happy to get into those. The third question related to the, what the law is related to disabled parking, specifically as to whether an establishment is closed and then if it's possible to use disabled parking after the establishment is closed without a penalty. The law does not leave any exemption for parking in a disabled parking spot after business hours. However, cities and counties can have different requirements as long as they're clearly posted. Fourth question related to what prompts the need for a notarized document to complete the title transfer transaction process. There's only one area where there's a requirement for notary public being signed, and that's where an affidavit is required. And that relates to ORS 803094 and does relate to Representative Hansen's question yesterday. Upon the death of the owner of the vehicle and the state is not probated, there needs to be an affidavit signed and naming the person who would then have ownership of the vehicle. So that's the one narrow area. And in order to eliminate that requirement, the statute would have to be changed. And the last question is, how much additional revenue is generated from the title fee increases? And looking at the last 14 months since the increase in the fee compared to the prior 14 months, you can see the total there, $28.4 million was collected in the prior 14 months, and in the 14 months since the increase, $84 million has been collected. Of course, that can't be totally correlated to being just the result of the title increase due to the transactions involved, but it does indicate the significant increase in the amount of revenues received. Mr. Chair, those are the answers to questions from yesterday, and open to any follow-up if you have it.
Looks good to me.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Greg Delpani, Administrator for the Motor Carrier Division. Happy to return today and finish up the presentation from where we left off yesterday. And that would be page 95 in your presentation material. I was just about to begin to speak about performance measurement. And I begin by observing that all agencies believe that what they do is having the desired effect. That is to say that agency activities are delivering the social outcome that's the agency's reason for existence. But how do they know that that is true? You know, answering that question actually has evolved the use of performance measurement at the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Initially, in 1991, when performance measurement was mandated by the legislature, performance measurement of the Motor Carrier Division, which was at that time housed at the Public Utility Commission, basically amounted to data collection. We collected a lot of data about inputs. We tracked production measures, how many trucks did we weigh, How many registration permits did we issue? How many license plates did we issue, et cetera? Phase two of an evolving performance measurement was characterized by moving from collecting a lot of input data to instead focusing on several key outcome measures. And at that point in time, we were looking at such things as reportable accidents, number of truck or driver inspections performed, weight citations issued, average phone wait time at permit offices, et cetera, et cetera. But at that point, we still weren't answering the question, so what? Did those particular activities actually move us closer towards the goal of achieving the purpose for which we exist? At that point in time, we moved to yet a third evolution, and we used the services of a statistical analyst in the Transportation Development Division to explore the statistical relationship between these data points we were collecting, the outcomes, the activities, and the results we were attempting to achieve. And in the process of doing that, we learned a great deal, and we actually settled upon three key performance measures, which through statistical regression analysis, we determined. We present these in a paired XY data set format. We determine that the first activity is a predictor of a second outcome, a desired activity. And we determine that there is a high degree of correlation, that the activity that's the predictor is actually leading us to attain the desired outcome, which is in accord with our mission, our reason for existing. So I think this will become clearer as I share with you the first performance measure, and that is there is a statistical correlation between driver-related critical safety violations and truck at fault accidents. The performance measure says as more truck drivers are placed out of service for critical safety violations, truck at fault accidents decline. Reducing truck at fault accidents links to Oregon benchmark number 45, reducing premature mortality, and reducing truck at fault accidents links to ODOT's goal of improving safety. So the result then is, over the last 4 years, by guiding our program choices and our investment of resources in accordance with this performance measure, we have seen a reduction in truck at fault accidents from 1999, 612, with successive annual reductions through 2002, 540. So we're seeing on the ground real-world reduction in truck at fault accidents and attendant mortality, and it is in keeping with our investment strategy and our use of our resources as guided by this performance measure, which was statistically validated and shows us that these actions that we're taking truly are directly impacting and helping us attain the social reason, reducing mortality, for which we exist.
Mr. Chairman, just one question.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the reduction in truck accidents, does that include the infamous Terwilliger curve? The less accidents in the Terwilliger curve?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I actually have data that can answer that question with specificity. I don't have it at my fingertips this morning, but I can tell you that our strategy, we have looked at the data points where the accidents occur, and we've created what we call AIM corridors. No one really remembers what the acronym stood for, but I think it's Accident Intensified Management Corridors. And we have directed not only our own staff but our law enforcement partners to focus their level two truck inspection activities in these AIM corridors. And we are reducing accidents in the AIM corridors. The Terwilliger curves is such a corridor, and I'll have to owe you the answer to the specific results in that area.
And my comment is that if it's great, absolutely wonderful, because that is a notorious curve in there. It's really an interesting curve with traffic, especially, and in that particular area. Thank you.
The second performance measure that I'd share with you is kind of a combination, and it keys on the program description that I provided to you yesterday of the green light intelligent transportation system, which bypasses safe and legal trucks and allows them to bypass our open way stations. Allowing safe and legal trucks to bypass way stations helps our enforcement officers manage what is a growing stream of trucks that are coming through the way stations. It eliminates travel delay for participating motor carriers, and it contributes to Oregon's goal of moving people and goods efficiently, and it also links to Oregon benchmark number 68, reducing highway congestion. It's kind of a two-part statement of a performance measure, and it says as more trucks are weighed, more weight citations are issued. And then the corollary is more static scale weighings lead to a citation as the green light system filters and pre-clears more legal traffic. Now, if you think about that, the trucks that are participating in green light that have a transponder device in the cab of their truck, they're weighed at freeway speeds, and the whole host of regulatory checks I described yesterday are performed electronically. And if the truck is deemed safe and legal and compliant with the weight standards, height standards, etc., it's allowed to move on down the freeway without entering into the way station. What we're doing is we're removing from the officer's examination at the static scales trucks that are safe and legal. Therefore, we're increasing...
Time to get under the desk.
Duck in the hole. Right.
Okay.
Oh, they're going to yell earthquake?
Yeah. We're
all
increasing.
Kind of shake around a little.
I'm a nosy. I have to go see.
We're increasing the number of trucks that likely do have some issue of noncompliance that are flowing through the way stations. And so as more trucks are weighed, more weight citations are issued in concert with the use of the green light system. Now,
Craig, let me stop you right there. One of the things I've noticed is if no one likes to be held up or put out of service as they approach one of these things, is the notice, the recognition that there's going to be a heightened inspection. Have you seen a decrease in a percentage of trucks or the million miles traveled type of measurements of the amount of problems with the trucks? In other words, rather than getting caught at your place, I'm going to go through it at my place and make sure before I get there I'm okay. Have you seen, as enforcement goes up, the ratio of problem trucks reducing?
Chairman George, I would say to you that the out-of-service percentage of trucks detected in Oregon approximates, but is actually less than, the out-of-service rate nationally, just by a percentage point. And the out-of-service rate for drivers in Oregon is substantially less than the national out-of-service rate. Now, that's either a reflection of more compliant drivers passing through Oregon, or it's a reflection of a superior enforcement effort. It's difficult to say with the data. I don't know that I can make that comparison effectively for you.
My personal experience in talking to other people that run trucks is there's a combination of things. It's first, the fact that you might get stopped. It's a good chance you might get stopped. Secondly, the fact that your personal insurance company is watching you and inspecting things and making sure everything is all right. And then just the recognition that there's just a tremendous liability if you have a truck involved in an accident. And I think all those things, and then the personal responsibility factor, the person just wants to be doubly do right.
You raise an excellent point. We live in a data-driven world, and increasingly data about motor carriers and their safety performance is available to the insurance industry on the World Wide Web. And motor carriers are increasingly conscious about how their safety profiles are impacting their bottom lines through insurance premiums. And then we have a very visible program. Oregon is characterized by having ports of entry, 6 ports of entry, 57 permanent way stations, dozens of other improved roadside locations for inspections, and we have partnerships with 57 other law enforcement agencies that creates a very visible presence throughout all of Oregon, and I think that is an effective deterrent. Okay. With regard to the size and weight program, some comparisons to other states. Oregon ranks in the top three in all the western states with regard to truck size and weight checks and weight citations and specific kinds of citations issued. In fact, Oregon is a leader nationally in the detection of a particular kind of overweight violation, which is somewhat technical in nature and requires a technically adept staff, axle group violations. A third performance measure is discussed on page 98. The work of the motor carrier audit section contributes to Oregon's goal of maintaining a high percentage of state roads in fair or better condition through their efforts to collect the weight mile tax and the registration fees that contribute to the highway fund that allows that work to be performed. This then links to Oregon Benchmark 72 road condition by recovering dollars owed to the state highway fund. This performance measure has determined that there is a statistically valid correlation that as more trucks are weighed and more scale crossing data points are recorded, auditors are recovering more weight mile tax dollars. Now, we use that information in a pragmatic, in a very objective kind of way, and we use it to direct the investment and the deployment of our motor carrier enforcement officer resources across the state. And in times of reduced resources, we've had to make choices about where to make cuts in staffing. We've used these performance measures to guide those kinds of decisions where we will achieve savings, not impacting the attainment of the program missions. In fact, I would say that the Motor Carrier Transportation Performance Measurement System allows us to maintain performance in a time of reduced resources. In the presentation material and in the remarks that I've made yesterday and this morning, you should take note that we have produced very real savings in significant dollar amount and in terms of FTE reduced. And yet, while doing so, we've continued to deliver excellent attainment of regulatory goals, and we have maintained an excellent customer satisfaction survey rating. So we're delivering on all three fronts simultaneously.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple years ago, and I wasn't directly involved with the Transportation Committee at the time, so I think I just skimmed through it, but there was a Secretary of State audit that related to the temporary weigh stations. Did that audit cause you to deploy people a little differently, or how have you responded to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, actually, the Secretary of State size and weight audit that you referred to was the impetus that gave rise to this most recent evolution in our performance measurement system. At the time, my gut told me that we were deploying our staff correctly and we were attaining an optimum result. And at the time, I believed that the Secretary of State audit was looking at one single component aspect of our mission, when in fact the legislature had given us a triumvirate of responsibilities. We do not exist solely to enforce size and weight. We exist to enforce size and weight. We exist to manage safety or regulate safety, and we exist to collect taxes. And the programs have to be looked at in a holistic sense. The question is, are we achieving balance and doing justice to each individual component of the threefold mission? My belief was that the Secretary of State audit was flawed in that it failed to consider the other two portions of responsibility, and it looked wholly at size and weight. As we examined that and used the tools of statistical regression analysis, the key finding that we determined here was that as more trucks are weighed and more scale crossings recorded, auditors recover more weight mile tax dollars. And the inverse, of course, is true. To the extent we take actions to deploy our staff in such a way as to reduce the scale crossing data points, we are effectively reducing our ability to collect weight mile tax. And another program relationship is, it is those very same scale crossing data points that are used to audit drivers' hours of service logbooks. And in finding drivers that have operated over their allowable hours of service, we're removing unsafe drivers from behind the wheel of the trucks. And that gets back to the first performance measure. As more truck drivers are placed out of service for critical safety violations, being out of hours is a critical safety violation, truck at fault accidents decline. So, in essence, we determined that if we were to follow the redeployment suggestions that were contained in the Secretary of State audit, we would have perhaps found some weight violations which are perhaps undetected on the secondary highway system. However, we would lose thousands of interstate scalings, which would directly reduce our weight mile tax recovery, and would also impact our ability to detect and remove drivers who are over their hours of service. However, just for the sake of prudence, we did fully implement the Secretary of State audit recommendations and did a 90-day pilot using their recommendations, and our gross number of citations and our rate of citations were both reduced, and the number of scale crossings was dramatically reduced so that we could anticipate these corollary impacts. But performance measurement guided our response to the audit, another valid use of them. Well, that brings me up to the point in time that I will conclude, kind of summarize what I've shared with you in the yesterday and today, and suggest to you that funding the work of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division is perhaps one of the best values in state government. The budget essentially buys an orderly and a structured trucking industry that conducts safe operations and pays its fair share for the use of Oregon highways. The investment taxpayers get, in return for the investment, taxpayers get management of the accounts for 26,000 motor carriers, processing of all highway use tax and fee payments, a system for the issuance and management of variance permits that provide for safe routing instructions for trucks and vehicles moving all over the state. It pays for a continuing evolvement of trucking online, which is numbers among the first in Oregon state government of this kind of credential being available to the citizens over the Internet, not only the ability to receive them, but also to remit payment for them. It provides for the operation of ports of entry, way stations, and portable scale sites that annually check millions of trucks for safe and compliant operation. It provides for the management of a green light system, which is reducing highway congestion, saving motor carrier time, and providing significant cost avoidance opportunity for the state. It's providing for roadside safety inspections of more than 28,000 trucks and drivers annually, and an additional 25,000 through our oversight of the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program. And it also provides for comprehensive audits of hundreds of trucking companies each year to determine if they're acting wholly in accord with the safety regulations. And with that, I'll conclude my presentation and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks, Greg. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Referring to page 100, Greg, what is included in your administrative costs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, administrative costs, I believe, are you asking generally for the definition of administrative expense or the specific content?
Content.
I think the best response I could give you to be provided, I could give you a detailed breakout. It's salaries of non-direct service providers.
It's a supervisory function within Motor Carrier Transportation Division, and Greg and a few other positions. We can get the list if you
want. Mr. Chairman, if we could, being a contractor, you tend to always think in terms of unit costs.
Mm-hmm.
And this administrative cost is one of the higher, in fact, it's the second highest of any of the cost per FTE that I've seen. Now, I know there are things that go in, different budgets have to include different things, but I just tend to flag things that are high. And so to understand what those details are within those administrative costs, it's helpful.
I can provide a breakout of how that was calculated.
Thank you.
Can you tell me on page 103, source of funds, and what happened in terms of the weight mile tax? And I know you've given a very good report on where you are weight mile taxes now, but what has called the fall from 429 in 99 to 385 in 03?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'd suggest that there's two reasons for a decline in weight mile tax receipts. One of them is that there was a reduction in the weight mile tax rate itself in a previous legislative session. And secondarily, there have been some impacts from the economy and the number of miles traveled.
Okay. So it's efficiency on their part.
I think the most significant contributing cause is the reduction in weight mile tax rates.
Okay. Gotcha. Thanks. One other thing. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. On sales charges, you have $32,099. What happened to 0103? What did you do to get that? My question is, how is it that you can't get more?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'm going to have to owe you that answer. As I sit here, I'm not immediately aware of the source of the
$32,313. Right. Okay. Well, don't. I don't want to nitpick, but it's just you just see it there and wonder: is there some kind of service that you were doing then that you don't do anymore that you could possibly recapture? No big deal. Don't worry about that one.
Relative to the weight mile tax, what is the status of the review of a current audit? Can you kind of tell us where we are in that process?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the lawsuit or?
Well, we have the settlement of the lawsuit, correct?
No, and the lawsuit is still pending.
It's still pending.
It's
okay.
At the appellate level.
Mm-hmm.
The appellant brief has been filed. The state's reply brief has been filed. As I understand the process, there's going to be an additional exchange of reply briefs over the next 2 or 3 months. Then the Supreme Court will, or rather the appellate court, will schedule oral arguments. And after having done so, it will be anywhere from 6 to 18 months until we reach a final decision.
Very good. Any further questions? Greg, just one final question. This is probably something you can get back to me on. My office has contacted your office over the last couple of years, and what I've been noticing is a diminishing number, but that is of folks who have felt that they were really treated rough in an inspection station. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing to provide, I don't want to use the word supportive environment because we're talking about here enforcement, but at the same time, if you've been into these weigh stations in other states, you're going to first of all come to the conclusion that it's better here than other places. But at the same time, my view, and you and I have talked about it before in the past, is that our desire should be to get them legal and get them going. And can you kind of give me, or do you have any training that way? You know, like courteous treatment of customer ideas like that?
Mr. Chairman, that's a reasonable question. And I'd say we approach that in this way. Sometime we're exception-driven. When we receive notification of the alleged inappropriate behavior, we clearly leave no stone unturned. We examine the issues. We speak to the motor carrier that alleges mistreatment. We speak to the officers involved. We speak to the local supervisor, and we're on fact-finding. I don't lose sight of the fact that oftentimes our encounters are adversarial in nature. That's the nature of a regulatory business. It's not fun to get an overweight citation. It's not fun to be put out of service. We teach and coach our staff to be professional, to be reasonable, to not be emotional, simply to relate what the requirement of law is and what the deficiency is and what the options are, and to treat people with courtesy and respect, and to be an attentive listener. Sometimes people just need to vent. That is active, ongoing training, coaching at the supervisor level. On occasion, we have found situations where the allegations have merit. And in those cases, we've taken appropriate disciplinary action with the offending staff person. I would tell you, however, though, that is extremely rare. For the most part, I'm happy to say that my belief is that staff are acting in a level, uniform, lawful manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only constituent complaint I've received, and it's a relatively minor issue, but maybe just keep it in the back of your mind, of truck driver coming in to point of entry in Southern Oregon. There was a dispute over whether or not the truck had insurance or not. It was resolved that the truck did indeed have insurance, but it took a while to get it verified. Driver was directed to a specific motel. He was taken out of service, but said, yeah, okay, you can go to such and such spot and wait until this is resolved. Well, it was probably one of the more expensive motels on that interchange. And the driver questioned whether or not he should have been allowed to, you know, not drive off, but at least be able to find a cheaper accommodation for the unscheduled delay. And I'm wondering if there's any policy in place in terms of when somebody's taken out of service but is allowed to get accommodations, is there a distance criteria, or is it the absolute closest motel, or what's the criteria that determines that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, of course it's difficult to deal with this without having all the particular facts, but the absence of insurance is not an out-of-service condition. The driver would have been allowed to have continued on his way had he chosen to do so. He would be subject to citation for not having insurance, but he would not be precluded from moving forward. Now, we do have an informational handout that's available at all of our facilities that is providing closest available facility. Generally, it's a truck stop. Sometimes it's a hotel where there's facsimile service available. We're not directive in that regard. We're suggestive. We're just giving options. And so it sounds perhaps something may have been lost in the transmission of the story to suggest that the driver was told he had to go to a specific hotel for that particular reason. I think if we were to be able to dig into that one, we'd find the story was somewhat different.
You hit on kind of one of my questions that I was, or thoughts that I was saying, having about what sort of services we should provide. Have somebody out of service, you know, I talked with you about one time having a cracked rim. Didn't believe it was cracked rim. The inspector was right. This was in Washington State, and the thing that amazed me was that they had no intention of providing you any mechanism to know who to call, where to call, and so on. You mentioned a little brochure. Did we provide that? You know, the following people, air brakes, you know, diesel engine repair, tires and services. I mean, a lot of folks, you know, always have the person that's on their first run, the person who doesn't, you know, often make that run, who now is in a strange area. Do we provide that sort of, there's a bulletin board with that's posted?
Mr. Chairman, as opposed to making a business referral to a mechanic or a tire changer, we have a bulletin board in our ports of entries, and local merchants are allowed to put their business cards on it. And when asked, we provide the yellow pages as well, and we'll provide assistance.
Most of them are packing cell phones today, so that's good.
Right.
Any further questions for Motor Care? Greg, thank you. Okay, at this time, we have transportation program development, and Lori's probably going to give us the first response, the first analysis, and then we'll go from there.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly from the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. And you should find in front of you a packet, gray packet, that's entitled Oregon Department of Transportation, Transportation Program Development. And if we'll take a look at page 2, you should see a sort of familiar worksheet here that shows a budget comparison of the division's budget over the last couple of time frames. This division works to plan and coordinate the use of transportation resources in the state. Also does things like inspect bridges, rate pavements, monitor traffic volumes, and inventory public roads. If you'll take a look at the columns over on the right-hand side, you'll see that the change in this division's budget between 2103 close of session figures and the 2003-05 governor's budget is an increase of about 12.1%. If you look at the column over that says the difference between through fifth special session and governor's budget, you'll see that increase drops slightly. This is in part due to the removal of general fund from the division's budget, as well as through the through fifth special session actions also include some adjustments made for salary increases during the course of the 0103 biennium. As part of special session actions, the transportation growth management program of approximately $240,000 was backfilled with transportation operating fund, the lawnmower money, what we talked about previously. Essentially, the division's budget is flat when you look at the change between 2103 and 2003-05 governor's budget. If you'll take a look at page 3 of the handout, you'll see that the division is sourced predominantly with other funds. A portion of these do come from federal resources that come in as federal as other for planning purposes. There's also some federal dollars for public works training programs, and then there's a lot of highway fund in this program area. The direct federal funds are for our safety dollars related to fatality analysis reporting system, that very small 0.3% you see on there. On page 4, highlights of the governor's budget. Like I just said, it's a 2.3% increase from the 2003 legislatively approved budget to the fifth special session. It uses other funds to offset general fund reductions and transportation growth management. It continues core programs, but does decrease capacity for some activities. It also adds resources to support engineering analysis, traffic counting, public works training, and an agency ramp pilot. On page 5, you'll see how the division spends its dollars by budget category. Total budget is $64.2 million total funds. The personal services side has about 233 positions, providing statewide supporting work for statewide and regional studies, technical assistance, analysis and research, and statewide transportation improvement program development, or that's the STIP. Expenditures and services supplies, and smaller amounts for capital outlay and special payments. On page 6, how we built the budget for 2003-05 is we started with the 2103 legislatively adopted budget of $57.3 million. Included some actions that had occurred over the course of the biennium up through the April 2002 point in time. In April 2002, the Emergency Board approved the movement of expenditure limitation and positions between Transportation Program Development and the Highway Division. These transfers completed the consolidation of highway planning and research activities approved by the 2001 legislature. The legislature had directed the department to move highway planning activities out of the Highway Division and combine them with the transportation program activities into one unit. So that's kind of the completion of this process. The net impact for transportation program development is an increase of 4.5 million in 50 positions. And you'll see this change, this bit of information come up again and again as we move into the highway division programs, and some of those positions and limitation is shifted among those divisions to come over to transportation program development. The budget also includes roll-up of 2,103 position actions and compensation changes. On page 7, essential packages that were included in the budget include package O&O, which relates to some personal services type adjustments. These include costs for temporaries, overtime, differentials, an adjustment for vacancy savings, and mass transit taxes of about $20,000. Package O2O includes a program adjustments. These are phase-in and phase-outs of one-time and ongoing costs. It includes phase-out for fleet acquisition budget, a phase-out related to an I-5 trade corridor grant, and a phase-out of some expenditures that had previously gone over to the governor's office to support activities there. The total phase-out is just under $2 million there. In package O3O included some adjustments for inflation and things on the state price list, including state government service charges, just over $1 million in increases for that package. On page 8, starting with policy packages included in the division's budget, package 070 is for revenue shortfalls. This transfers 4 positions to the bridge program and decreases expenditures based on the agency's revenue projections and allocations of highway fund among programs. This allows the division to maintain core activities, but does decrease capacity for technical assistance and some planning activities. I believe this predominantly will impact the division's ability to turn things around maybe as quickly as it could have with the additional resources. Package 081 relates to actions taken during the 2002 third special session. It eliminates cost of living increases for 3 positions at salary range 38 or higher. Package 082 is the fund shift I mentioned earlier, which took place during the 2002 fifth special session. It shifts $242,000 of general fund and expenditures to other funds, and this does support transportation growth management activities, and it's supported by Transportation Operating Fund or Lawnmower money. Package 187 relates to the Mill Creek building rent pilot. This division's also, a portion of it's housed at Mill Creek, and this will allow this division to participate in the program by reducing some services, supplies, line items, and shifting those expenditures into a rent line item to let the department implement its pilot project here. Page 9, additional policy packages. Package 400 relates to transportation system monitoring. This would add 2 engineering positions to conduct traffic monitoring activities. The package expenditures of $175,000 other funds are supported by a corresponding decrease in professional services, so this package has a net zero impact. These positions in this package will provide traffic data for studies, planning, and analysis projects within the division. Package 401, transportation engineering analysis, is also a self-funded net zero package. It adds 1 position to provide statewide quality control and training for system planning, solution selection, and project development. This will allow the division to provide some statewide consistency in its transportation analysis activities. The position costs approximately $150,000 other funds, and like I said, is paid for through reductions in some other expenditure line items. Package 402, Public Works Enhanced Training. I think it says enhanced on your handout. This package, in the amount of $80,000, makes a current half-time position full-time to support some new technical training for public works professionals. It's the cost is shared between some federal and local government dollars to support this training. Page 10, Package 403, Highway Cost Responsibility Study. It's a net zero package. It adds 1 position and moves this study to the agency from the Department of Administrative Services. The Highway Cost Allocation Study is used to allocate the cost of Oregon's highway system among different vehicle types and weight classes to determine who should be paying for what portion of the system. Since the publishing of the governor's budget, and the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Transportation have been working together and taking a look at this package and would like to modify it as follows. They would like to forget about creating the new position at ODOT and leave the study at the Department of Administrative Services, but also increase the amount that ODOT is sending over to DAS for study support. This study has been over at DAS over the last biennium, and they believe this will continue to provide a good product and provide some sense of credibility, but it takes it away from the department slightly so that DAS is kind of more directly overseeing this project. Package 404, Transportation and Growth Management Program Transfer. This is another change since Governor's Balanced Budget was published. The Department of Transportation is working with the Department of Land Conservation and Development on a program they share that works with transportation and growth management issues. This package would move four positions from DLCD to ODOT. The package cost of about $500,000 other funds would be supported by decreases in special payments from ODOT to DLCD. Currently, transportation is sending money to DLCD to support the positions there. This would bring the positions over to ODOT, and so that funding going over would be pulled back as well to help support the costs within transportation. And currently, a portion of these positions is being supported by general fund in DLCD. So transportation would pick up that general fund piece by making a reduction in special payments internally. So what previously is supported by some positions that were previously supported by some general fund would now be fully supported by other funds resources. Both agencies believe that this will improve cost-effective program delivery for the program. It will put some of the administration and planning folks together, co-locate them, provides for some efficiencies there, and probably eliminate some redundant work areas and workstations, and also combine all the files in one spot. So that's pretty much my summation of the governor's budget. If you have any questions?
Senator Boris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is a question for LFO. I don't know. We have budgets that are coming forth, some reflecting the governor's request for no increases, others incorporating the increases. And I see you've selected, for some reason, some positions that you're not going to have a cost of three positions at salary range 38 with no cost of living. What is happening in the governor's recasting budget? Because these were, I'm sure, prepared before the governor made that decision. And what will happen in these new budgets?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we'll make the adjustments for those for the governor's recommendations for, well, his request to pull back on merit increases and cost of living adjustments will be made in a technical adjustment. When we go into work session, we'll do that at the table here. When he is out there talking about his budget, he's talking about a budget with those numbers reduced. But as you're seeing the budgets come forward, the agencies should be pointing out to you where those merit increases are, you know, going to be adjusted as we go. And I don't know if a part of your question is to do with some budgets are showing policy packages where there are increases. Those are mostly going to be in other funded agencies, as ODOT is. And the co-chairs have instructed subcommittees that their goal is no new positions unless the subcommittee finds that that's a critical need to provide services in those areas. So that's your decision.
Follow-up? My understanding is that there was a desire for a state policy with respect to general fund positions, other fund, federal funds, that all would be treated the same. And is that, in fact,
that's true.
Happening?
Yes.
Okay.
Any questions for Lori? Lori, thank you again.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Craig Greenleaf. I'm the administrator for the Transportation Development Division, and I'm representing the transportation program development portion of the budget, which includes both elements that administratively are handled inside the Highway Division and within my own division, but are generally included together, as Lori's presentation described, under the heading of the transportation program development portion of the budget. The mission for our particular area of work is to provide direction and informed
decision-making with respect to the long-term implications for the transportation system. We do that through a number of different techniques. My particular reference here is on page 106 of the overall presentation document. And we do that through data collection, and we specifically apply the data collection methodologies that we use in order to deal with management systems issues, that is, what is the condition of the bridges, what's the condition of the pavement, and so on. We also assist in engineering analysis and looking at the engineering implications of various transportation improvements. We do transportation modeling, which assesses what the implications of particular improvements might be, what byproducts or effects there would be to those things. We also do analysis of research work and methodological changes for the department. We're involved in access management with the policy direction work that we do there and policy development generally. We do this in four different areas of work that are described inside the budget document. This first area is statewide and regional studies. Here we have our work on behalf of the highway cost allocation studies. Lori's already indicated is one of the areas of work that we do here. We also do it for broad policy direction for the department. This includes the Oregon Transportation Plan, the Oregon Highway Plan, and other kind of broad policy documents that we work with. We support the work of the Freight Advisory Committee, which is a legislative creation last session to create a specific committee to look particularly at the issues of freight movement in the state. Our strategic plan and special studies work is another area, and we follow up on specific requests and analysis around TAC comparison issues and other legislative points of inquiry. We do safety studies and other kinds of technical analysis work in this particular area. Regional planning is probably one of the areas that we have highlighted the most. It's an area where our interaction with local government is the most intense. Through this work, we support the work of local government in the work that they do on behalf of transportation system plans. This is the analysis that local governments perform in order to look at the implications for how their system plans are going to be necessarily amended as a result of growth, change in demographic conditions, changes that may be resulting from economic conditions and so on that are happening inside that particular community. And they're tailored to deal with the specific instances and issues that that particular community is confronting. We do this in part through our support of the Transportation Growth Management Program. We also do this in specific instances where we do facility plans around key areas of work for the state's transportation system. The second major area of work for us is around the issues of technical assistance and coordination. Here we work with local governments in supporting them as they look at their own comprehensive plans. We also support work through the metropolitan planning organizations, including the two newly created metropolitan planning organizations in Corvallis and Bend, as well as the ones that have been around for some time. We also work with the statewide coordination efforts, which includes our support of the Area Commissions on Transportation, as was referenced by our chairman as he presented the budget overview and talking about the Area Commissions on Transportation and the key role that they have inside the agency's work and consideration of program improvements. Another area that we have been working on is issues of access management and coordination. Through this work, we have created administrative rules dealing with how driveways and street connections are handled inside the process of approval for those particular connections. We're in the process, actually, of amending those rules
as a result of examination of the implications of having those rules in place for a couple of years. We're looking at some editing and trying to streamline and improve the decision-making practices that surround that particular area of our work.
Can you tell me if we've improved the median openings and the safety up in Woodburn? I didn't get a chance to go to the first meeting, and I wasn't sure that we had done anything in that area.
Porter, are you talking about the high school?
Yeah, that
was done right after we had those hearings last session.
So it was done.
Yeah, it's greatly improved.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, that most of those specific projects would be projects that you'll hear more about when John Rosenberger presents the Highway Division's work. The specific construction activities are handled inside that portion of the budget, but in many instances, the work of our division and the various planning personnel that are in the regions are to assist in trying to look at the places where those improvements are necessary, and that's the work that we support inside the particular area of the budget I'm presenting today.
Craig, relative to access management, I noted it throughout the budget. There's more money for access management. And yet, when I look at it, when I take the phone calls, or when we personally experience it like we did a year ago, this is a monster that we have created. I mean, this is let me give an example. Two little homes on a very, very rural state highway. And the cost to folks that were building an inexpensive little Adair home was over $5,000 each just to get the required access, which was a brand new pavement that had to be there. And as both of them suggested to me, why is it we would be paving it when they don't even have pavement where the county road comes into the state highway? And the amazing thing, and we'll probably have some testimony later when we have public hearing because these people want to come in and talk about this, is the convoluted mechanism they had to go through. And repeatedly people coming out there to look at it who had no idea, you know, what was really happening. And then the very fact that you were dropping in massive paving equipment to pave an area about from here to that chair by 23.5 feet long. And that was very, very disturbing to watch that. But then let's take it to the next level and let's start talking about businesses that are telling us that they do not have access to property, and we'll hear about this later. A piece of property that's probably one of the most valuable pieces of property in Newburgh that probably has a value of zero now because of what's being planned. The city says that they're basically being pushed by your division. Another piece of property that probably everyone would recognize up at Six Corners, a piece of property that is literally landlocked. Even though we provided access to right across the street a piece of property, it's almost as if this person is being disciplined for some reason. And a very, very valuable piece of property that is not farmed, that is never going to be farmed, hasn't been farmed for years, and yet because of this access restriction, they cannot develop it. And all over the state, we continue to hear this. Business people are saying, listen, this is destroying my business, what is being required. And a couple of them, in which I've gone to look at them and found that I actually think it caused a safety problem. We weren't improving safety, we created a safety problem. So I hope you will focus on this because I'd like to get an understanding of why, when the legislature, I think, sent a clear message that we expected access management to be reasonable and supportive to business, that in fact it seems to be the opposite of that. And local jurisdictions are telling me they're being pushed to a certain conclusion which does not benefit their local businesses. I mean, from Martin Luther King Avenue, remember, Senator Carter, when we had those folks in here talking about what was being done to minority businesses, and to big, big box stores that are telling us they've never dealt with anything like this. So are you going to tell me that our administrative rule changes are going to be more supportive, or we can look for more of this kind of regulation?
Mr. Chairman, I would freely acknowledge that the access management is one of the most demanding areas of work that we have. It is technically complex. It is demanding not only because we are dealing with the specifics of access management in a particular frontage on the state highway system, but it's also often tied up with a local land use proceeding that may be everything from a conditional use permit to a plan amendment or zone change in a specific community that's undertaking the support of that particular development proposal. Each of those sets of considerations make the challenge of having it work out in a way that's satisfactory to all of the key interests that are at the table. We seriously undertook the work on behalf of Access Management, and we have now had the experience of seeing some of the places where the way the rules work on a day-to-day basis isn't necessarily smooth in operation. That's part of what we're trying to accomplish with the revisions. That aren't as clear as they could be. That's one of the other places that we found that we could be clearer about how the procedures are to work. At the same time, the approval rate for the access permits that we do have before us is in the vicinity of 94-95% approval rate. So the vast majority of these cases come to a result that authorizes the permit to be issued. Sometimes the particular way in which that permit is authorized is not necessarily to the full satisfaction of the affected party. In the cases that you described, that certainly seems to be the result that you are hearing from the constituent interest. We are often also dealing with complications that arise from the fact that we're seeing properties redeveloping in an area that has already been developed. In other words, there may be access in proximity to adjoining properties, or there may be access across the road that has some implications for how we handle that specific project or that particular proposal. And all of those considerations necessarily have to feed into the judgments that are being made about access management. We are working hard to try and improve the levels of discretion that the rules would afford us in making sound engineering judgments about these issues, trying to eliminate procedures that are, I think, frustrating not only to the applicant but to the staff and that are trying to support this work. And we are looking to try and find ways that each of these features can be handled inside the process that is supportive of the work overall. We take the issues that you're raising very seriously, and we're working continuously to try and improve our performance in that area.
Well, just to follow up on that, and that is one of the things when we talk to the governor today, we want to talk about this issue because I think this is impacting our economy. I really do. I mean, I hear from folks who can't get trucks to their stores in order to make deliveries. I'm going to give you an example. I swung in on Saturday night to get a pizza from a little shop in Newburgh, and I did a dance with another pickup in the driveway of this. I mean, literally, it was a dance. We commented about who was leading, who was following, in order to get access to this place. And this was the purpose of this destruction to this business was been for the purpose of getting a bicycle lane in. And somebody commented when I was in that pizza shop about, I've never seen a bicycle out there. Probably we're not going to. We wouldn't want to ride in that traffic. But the point of it is that we see that. That's just one example of hundreds or thousands in which we have folks saying, this has greatly impacted my business. And the problem is, a lot of times, it is almost impossible. And I remember when we had folks in testifying, Senator Durfler had a group meeting on this issue. And they said, here's the facts. You inconvenience me twice getting into your business, and I don't come back. I'll find some place that's more convenient. And I really think that we've got to rethink this whole process. I don't see the aid to the highway flow or traffic safety. What I see is what almost seems to be punitive action against business, almost like we... And I had a note out of employee tell me that a few years ago. There shouldn't be business on a state highway. Well, that's unbelievable because it's the business that yields the money for this agency. So this is a serious issue for us, hoping that we get some public testimony that'll shed some light on where we are. Because we have an economy that's in the tank, and I think this may be an important factor.
Other than another editorial, you can't have an answer to a question that wasn't asked.
Senator Dukes?
Did I understand correctly, because I only got a piece once I was coming in, that you were saying you were hoping to put some things in place that would allow some flexibility with access management and allow you to be sort of adaptive to the situation that you're working with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, yes.
Then I have a challenge for you.
Okay.
The 101 highway project in Seaside. And I'm dead serious. This is, third or fourth time ODOT has brought the project to Seaside. And we work it out to a point. It's usually pretty bloody by the time we get there, but there'll be a few public hearings. We actually got it on the ballot once. And then ODOT decides that we're not doing it right and we're not giving enough, and so they walk away. A few years later, because it's a project you really want to do, they bring it back. Well, we're in about our third or fourth iteration of this sucker at this time. And it come back looking just like it looked when it left before. We've done pieces of it. They finally broke it up into about three segments so we could please do something out of this. And we've done the pieces, some of them. And we're going to have finally a top-level sit-down meeting very soon there to try to work some of this out. I quite honestly am embarrassed to go to my constituents and say, I'm sorry, I know it looks just like it did before. I don't know what to tell you. They've changed personnel. They've changed staff. They don't know the history of the thing. I've been through at least five mayors down there on this project, and the main issue is access. That's not the only one, but that's the main issue. Got another one in Warrenton where I'm going to have to call Al, but I think you're putting him out of business, literally. And you know it. You've accommodated everybody else, but can't accommodate him as long as that raised median stays here. So I am dead serious when I say this is a project we are working on now. Show me that you want flexibility.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't believe in access management, Mr. Chairman. And you can't tell it from that statement I just made. Those highways were meant to get you from point A to point B, and I believe in that. But these people were all given driveways. A lot of them are holding a piece of paper that says they have illegal access. So if you gave them driveways, you better not try to run them off now.
Would you want me to respond, Mr. Chair?
That wasn't a question.
I would, Mr. Chairman, at least try and draw a distinction between two different circumstances that we've talked about with respect to this access management question. The circumstances that are described in the case of Seaside are access management issues that are specific to an improvement or a project that we're trying to construct there. They are somewhat distinct from the circumstances that also surround access management when we're dealing with a specific request to connect a driveway to the state system. The rules which we have put together here are principally aimed at the issue of the permit issuance question. They were not designed to accomplish the purposes of trying to design the specifics around a particular project. And we've tried to give ourselves the recognition and latitude that we inherit a condition with respect to any project that we undertake that is necessarily going to have to be tailored to the particular project and try and work out the details about how that project can come together with some rationality and achieve the purposes that we're trying to achieve with respect to the project. Again, I would acknowledge the Seaside project is one that has been extremely challenging, I think, from every chair that's being occupied in any conversation about the project. It's been a challenging project to try and fashion answers that are supportive of the business interests that are along that highway, that work to being able to show the through movements be made effective in that particular segment of the highway. To compromise where it's necessary to compromise in order to fulfill both of those aims simultaneously. I believe that we've tried to support business interests, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, to hear your your description about somebody who thought businesses ought not join the highway.
Because there's some senators who have had that comment made to them.
That certainly is not the direction that our administrative rules would suggest, nor our support of the local comprehensive plans that have been created in those communities. I'm very apologetic to hear that representation of our work, because I don't think that represents the agency vantage point.
But something that seems to represent the agency's vantage point that also disturbs me as we're doing highway projects is the little guy who's selling pizza gets to go make his case in a public hearing and may or may not get listened to. Fred Meyer always gets listened to.
Let's go to Florence and see that.
Oh, well, let's try Tillamook and Seaside and St. Helens.
Right.
They always end up with at least one traffic light, regardless of what your rules say. They never end up with a raised median out in front. And what I am saying, very point blank, is that there is a different set of rules, depending upon how much corporate dollars you've got to put behind it and how many lawyers you can amass. And a little guy who's just trying to sell his pizza can't play in that game, and he shouldn't have to.
But he or she will have to hire lawyers, because that's the sad thing. Let's just back up to that, because I'm going to point out that the big guys do get hit. Let's go to Newburgh, Highway 99W and Springbrook. That's not my district any longer, but I can talk about it anyway because I care about the community. And at that intersection, we have a right turn only into the Fred Meyer and all the new complex that's been built there. We have, they complied with that, even though we changed things several times during the process. We completely redid 99W and the Springbrook exchange, the crossroad with Springbrook, and at that time put in massive wide sidewalks. I mean, you can drive on these things. They're that big. At the same time, we never did provide, and I think it was intentional, never did provide a left turn lane if you're southbound into the Fred Meyer. Now we're being told that that entrance is going to be closed. That means that all of the cars who come from all of the mobile home parks and the subdivisions down south of town coming up Springbrook now are going to be required to get on 99W only to come into a reduced number of exits. The other thing is that there was plenty of room to get a left turn lane at that point, just so that people could get a left turn, get off of the southbound traffic, and get into left turn lane to go in there. That, in fact, is the intersection, and that change of that access to Fred Meyer is the one that's impacting the fellow I pointed out in Newburgh, whose property has gone to a value of zero. A major, major restaurant company wanted to come in there, and they said, no way are we accepting a right in and a right out, because the right out sends you south down through the community with a very difficult way to get back to the main route. If you're going to stop on the way to the coast, you're not going to stop there. And so they looked at it and said, no way we can do it. Anyone who's looked at that thing has said, there's no question we can solve that. Getting a safe turn into Fred Meyer, providing him access to that property. So this is a major problem. And this is a person who's now retired, who had hoped that this was going to be, since his stock portfolio is worth zero, was hoping that his property might be worth something. And the point of it is, I'm surprised the rest of these guys aren't talking. Everyone I talk to,
haven't
given them a chance. Okay. Yeah. Another tirade. Go ahead. Did anybody else like to tirade here?
I'd like to jump in a little too on this issue. Access management is incredibly important, and especially in the urban area, you see mistakes that were made 20 years ago or 40 years ago that we're still having to live with and create huge problems. So good planning and good access management is just absolutely vital. My interest and concern, and I'm wondering if there's a way that you can track the time duration of how long it takes for the decision-making process, because I'm very interested in how fast we can get projects from the idea to the start of construction or even the finish of construction. And we've had, in the urban area, we've done work trying to coordinate between various building code agencies, and transportation access seems to be one of those things that can delay a project getting started significantly. And I'd like to see if there's, you know, certainly any way that these decisions can be fast-tracked, moved timely, so that the contractors, the developers, not so much, my concern isn't so much what the decision is, but how fast and how timely the decision is made. And that construction is so, there are so many different aspects to construction planning and permitting that I think we're getting a pretty good handle on the construction part of it, but the transportation permitting and then the fire code questions that come up at the end, those two things that are really outside of building code interpretations and can significantly add to the cost of getting a project going. So that the timeliness, I think, is my biggest concern, and how we can get a handle on that, and how improved management techniques can speed that part of the process, because it's just vital to economic development.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we share your interest in a speedy decision process. The 1999 session passed Senate Bill 773, which set a performance standard of 120 days for the decisions that we make on access management permitting. The choice of 120 days, I believe, was chosen because it matches the timeline for the land use proceedings that are typically connected to them. When we put together the administrative rule, we were careful not to necessarily demand a particular sequence to decision making. In other words, you can come to us, secure the permit for access before you go to the local government to try and gain approval for the land use process. Or alternatively, you can go to the local government and begin with them and try and do the land use process before, or you can do them simultaneously, whatever seems to be it's the applicant's call about how they wish to proceed with that particular agenda. We try and make our decision within 60 days and use the last 60 days of that 120 in order to handle any appeals that might arise from that particular proceeding. So, and we've been working to try and perfect a performance measure that speaks more specifically to this issue so that we can make some reasoned judgment about, you know, the vast majority of our cases being done well inside of that 120 days. So, for example, like 90 days or so, so that there isn't an unreliability as to time about those decisions. I think our performance is reasonably good with respect to timing. Those cases that do go to appeal are obviously the ones that take the longest time. But we've tried to provide even flexibility in how we handle the appeals by providing the opportunity for a mediated result. In other words, bringing someone to deal with us in a mediation kind of context, actually have a region review process which includes staff from the rest of the department, doesn't necessarily just deal with the region staff who may have been dealing with the permit issue in that specific case and tries to bring some new personalities into the equation to make sure their consistency is achieved, or allowing the applicant to proceed directly to a contested case kind of proceeding to think that that's the most effective. Again, the applicant's call as to basically how to proceed with those appeals opportunities. And this is one of the places that we're seeking to have flexibility in how we handle the specific permit questions around those kinds of cases. But we do put up an important factor on the timeliness of our decision making.
Representative Creek.
Chair, being Bruce is here, Bruce, I can't let you get by without talking about Misty Meadows, because it's a classic. We've had the property since early 70s, the property in the off of Highway 101, south of Bannon. gravel driveway goes off in one of the, used to be a small fruit stand, which was expanded to a building about the size of this here with a roof and set back, and probably the building wasn't located where it really should have been when they rebuilt. I think that was part of the problem, but the land use and building permit didn't coordinate with state highway. But the people paved it. ODOT decided they didn't like that, so they made them take the pavement out. The mailbox was, for 37, 40 years, had been down at the end with a white spot. They knew the mailbox was out in front of it. So the mailman had to stop right where the people making the right turn to come in. He's almost got to that. Finally, we got that moved. Had Bruce come down. Bruce was a great help, really. But they put up a berm about that high, 35 feet long, across the driveway, past the building, so everybody had to go around it. And it, even though it narrowed everything down, because there was a broach in the hill, trying to get in and out, if you're making a left-hand turn, when someone's making a right-hand turn coming in, it was dangerous. So I did have them come down. We looked at it, and finally they got permission for a larger easement. But now if you went and looked at that berm, there's constantly tracks over the top of the cars with mystic gauge, or they'd have a trailer or something behind them, or a large towing vehicle, they'd go over the top of it. Well, it's worked back now to about the length of that desk, and what's that berm's left about this. And I was kidding Bruce the other day. I said, what if I went by there, I got a picture of myself with a shovel and a wheelbarrow. Why not just take out the other 5 or 6 feet? It makes it safer. Although I have to admit, they did accommodate pretty much what the guy wanted to do. But there's a letter in the file, which I sent to Bruce from one of the employees of ODOT on the access, where if you keep fighting us on this, we'll shut you off totally and you can go down to the other road and try to make your access down there. Real arrogant. In my letter to him, which is on file, I said, if in my power, I'd fire him just for that letter. Let him go to his union. That's how fast I'd have done it. That would have been the end of that. But there are improvements being made, I think, in this issue. And I think Bruce has worked hard with his staff. We're making progress. And I think what you're hearing today, as far as I can see, continue to work, continue to improve. And I think to me it's to give you encouragement to continue to move forward in some of these issues that are difficult. So I caution you not to fall back. I think it comes from the top down through the agency.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain the contested process and who the final adjudicator is?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I can't give you the precise details, but some sessions back, the various hearings entities that the various agencies have had were consolidated into a hearings panel that is now run centrally for the state. In the event that you want to take the agency's action, it is sent to the hearings panel, and an administrative law judge then sits in review of that particular case. It's not employed by ODOT. In other words, the appeals process is separated from the agency, and the proceeding is held using the administrative procedures that are part of that hearings panel's responsibility, and those cases are then made, judgments are rendered by the hearings panel, which is, you know, the agency is allowed to present its case before the panel. The applicant presents their case before the panel, and that ruling of that administrative law judge is the final conclusion out of the particular results of the on an access management case. That's the way that's handled.
Of the 6% that are contentious, how many of them? What percent of those go to contested case hearings?
Actually, some of the ones that end up in an approved status have gone through the process of actually being contested at an earlier point. There are some of those that don't achieve an approved status that actually
there may be circumstances related to the applicant, an issue related to financing, or some other absence of being able to achieve an option on a property or whatever, that might be other reasons that the case doesn't proceed. A relatively small percentage, I can't give you the precise number of our caseload that goes to a contested case proceeding, but it's a very small percentage of the total cases that we deal with. I can certainly provide that number to you in follow-up. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Other than if a high percentage of the problems wind up in contested hearings, then yeah, we do have a problem, and I would like to see that information. But if they don't, then that's not worth it. I don't know whether that's helpful to the committee or not. But.
Well, Craig, one of the things that I've noticed, if you're in another state, and you're particularly, I'm looking at the benchmarks, and Senator Dukes pointed this out to me, and benchmark number one, rural jobs. Number four, net job growth. When I'm in those states, I look, because I've been interested in transportation since I was a little bit of a kid. I always look to see what they're doing and how it functions. I see them supporting their local business, particularly in the rural areas, where there's a state highway going from one town to another. In another state, you always find that they make provision for that local business. Whether it's a local access road, you know, whatever, there's some provision made to keep those businesses thriving. But what I find is, and the experience in Newburgh was classic, plus on the coast, I mean, I could gift you a portfolio of these things, in which it was almost like, we're not here to help you solve our problem. Okay, because they didn't have a problem before. They had access to the property, and maybe, like we said, a deed in their hand. But what we've done, we've set up what I believe is an aggressively adversarial process that requires these people to spend enormous amounts of money. They finally relent because they just can't do, you know, their business survival is on the line. And whether it's a tire company that can't get trucks any longer in there, and a major portion of their business was trucks to service tires, because it's too narrow. Because we do have the situation where the tire trucks are, the truck tires are going over the berms. I can show you that where they're going right over sidewalks, where we narrowed them up. And yet we made no offer to buy out the business and say, why don't you move to another location? And that's my concern. I just see this as other states providing a supportive environment for their business, for us taking what I believe is, I'm going to be very straightforward with you, I believe it's adversarial. I see us entering in, the state entering in, to local land use planning, trying to impact the person at the local level, and whether it's city or county. Now, tell me I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Chairman, you and other members of the committee have laid out a number of specific instant cases where you think that the results have been applied in a manner that was detrimental to the applicant's interest. I certainly am not in a position to speak to those instant cases. I just don't know them. That, you know, there are hundreds of cases that come through, and I can't speak to any of the particulars. As you heard from Representative Krieger earlier, clearly, when the agency's management knows about problems of this sort, we certainly try to seek out an answer that is satisfactory. However, that's a poor excuse for poor performance on the part of our staff. If we have people who are not handling the proceedings in a way that is in recognition of the business interests that are at the table and the relative importance of the access management question relative to that business interest, then I believe they're not performing the duties that we've assigned them inside their responsibility even to deal with the particulars of the access management case. We have tried through training. We've tried through trying to create a consistency in the way people have handled these cases. We're asking for some additional support around this issue, even this legislative session, to try and better improve the capacities of the department to deal with these cases. You know, a bad attitude is something that is unsatisfactory no matter when it comes forward. There are interests here that may for which we may not reach reconciliation as to the shared interest in terms of the result.
but I believe that it's seriously our interest to try and support this work as best we can.
We've probably listed off five things today, and there's 50 more behind them. So I would want to encourage you not to think that, I mean, when Representative Krieger was talking, he could have been talking about Rainier. Do you know that ODOT actually built an asphalt mound across an existing access to block it? They later took it out after some discussion, but I could not believe that they'd actually, as part of their project, would go in, and because the guy just wouldn't understand. He no longer had an access there. They actually built a mound in front of it so he couldn't access it. So I want you to understand, it's not that just we've had one or two. There are legions of these out there. And I wanted to ask two things. One is, as the chair was pointing out, you have three performance measures, and then there's this stuff up above that says related Oregon benchmarks, and the first one listed is rural jobs. So I would encourage you to develop a performance measure and work with Susie on it that would talk about what it is you're trying to do through planning that I think is legitimate and is necessary. Believe me, I support the planning, especially in undeveloped areas, but that would also encourage and support the rural development, and I think that would help us resolve some of this. But the other piece is, and this is an honest question, if I have a piece of property and I discover that the state is going to build a highway project out in front, and I go to a public hearing and I see that the map says I'm not going to be able to get access to my property, or I have two accesses now, I'm only going to have one when I'm done, or I have a right and left in and out now, and I'm only going to have a right in and out. What does the book say that I do? I want to know that there's a manual someplace that says how these things are handled. I have a concern with ODOT. I don't know any of you people. I just run my business, pay my taxes. What does the book say I do?
There are two principal sources. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes. There are two principal manuals, if you will, with respect to handling this particular question. One is the access management rules that I've made reference to up to this point. The other principal device that's used is actually the Highway Design Manual that also specifies some of the technical standards that we meet when we're doing projects. Some of those things are set by federal obligation. The receipt of our federal funds sets certain obligations for how we handle certain project types and certain kinds of project details in order to receive those dollars.
I'm probably not going to understand that stuff if I'm just the property owner who's been making pizza and want to keep on making pizza and like life the way it was. How do I know where to go at ODOT, who to talk to? Because in my experience, my constituents go to a variety of people. The guy out there trying to lay the asphalt, the highway engineer because they met him at a meeting, maybe the project manager because they met that person, or the public information officer because they were at a meeting that he or she was at. And then they come in at all different, and then, of course, they get a hold of us. So I don't know who, and I want to believe that somewhere at the regional level there's a book that says all of these complaints are filtered through to this person. And this person we can train to work with real-life people, and that they can learn how to negotiate, and that they know what the rules are and where their flexibility is. Because I'm not sure you got one of those in every region. Do you? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, for the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Obviously, your issue is we need somebody in the regions that can talk to people and talk to them in a way that they understand the rules, they understand why the rules are there, and they understand and can support, frankly, where we want to go. And if we have a disagreement, let's have somebody that can understand what the issue is and how we can get to something that hopefully is amicable and acceptable to all folks.
But I'd also like that there's communication from top to bottom so they don't keep telling you that a project is okay, and then I come in and tell you it's not okay.
Right. correct. And I hear you. And obviously, that position, we're trying to establish positions that can do that. And that's the area manager position in every region. And we have varying levels of skills in those positions. We have some that are very good and some that will be good with further training. And we want somebody that can talk with folks. And I want to also let you know that I hear you. I've heard you in terms of access management, and it is a priority for me. And I think it's important to me because it is balancing all of the issues we talk about, which deal with mobility, safety, and economic development. And access management will be contentious. It always will be contentious. And I guess I would like to suggest that maybe we come back, and if you want to do it in this meeting or some other meeting, especially dedicated to that, we're doing a number of things. My staff knows that I want us to be better at access management. I believe we are better at access management than we were 2 years ago. And with some of the changes that we're putting in place in terms of changing our administrative rules per the direction of the legislature, we are going to have more flexibility. We are going to be able to address some of those issues out there. Hopefully we'll be able to address some of the differences between rural and urban Oregon, because one of the things I hear loud and clear is something that works great in Beaverton really doesn't work very well in Lakeview. And we need to have the flexibility to deal with that. And I think you should understand some of the changes that our commission just gave us the go-ahead to start going out to the public to talk about changes to our administrative rule that get to the heart of many of the issues you're talking about. More importantly, I think you'll probably find nobody that's more pro-development than I. I want to do it in a way, though, that's responsible, and I think that everybody here appreciates that. But our intent should be to work with property owners in a way to address their needs, but also protect this highway system, the mobility and safety of that system. Sometimes we're at odds, and everybody knows we don't want to have new access points on the interstate freeway system, as an example. We understand what that would be. One of the things that we've been struggling with, and which I think is at the heart of the issues you're talking about here, is where should we be more restrictive and where can we allow, frankly, less restrictions and essentially allow traffic to degrade, the traffic levels to degrade further. And we haven't done a good job of demarcation of what is an expressway or a freeway versus where we want to allow the urban area to develop more intensely, because frankly we want those areas to develop more intensely, because if they can't develop more intensely, then they're going to start spilling out further down the roadways and there'll be more sprawl. So we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, and I think if you want to, we'd be glad to come back. First off, give you some of the actual statistics, because we are tracking now very clearly, because of the direction of the legislature, how we're doing in a performance of access management. I think you'll be pleased with what we're doing. But those 5% that we still have out there are very contentious. They will continue to be contentious. I think with the changes, we'll get to more of those. But I also want to make it clear that we want to, again, just like we're doing in all the other areas, measure how we're doing in performance, not just in terms of numbers, in terms of efficiency and effectiveness of the process, but also customer satisfaction. And Craig and his staff will tell you that we'll shortly have monitoring systems in place so that we can get some real live feedback so that we can identify some of the areas where we need to improve along the lines that Greg Delpani talked about in terms of his motor carriers. So I would like to suggest that maybe we have a further discussion about this. Also on the project side, I'll ask John Rosenberger when he comes up to maybe explain some of the things that we do in our projects to deal with access, but also more importantly, I think, deal with some of the problems you have on that specific project, because I personally want that project to go forward and get done so that, again, we can do the improvements that are needed there in Seaside, but also have a project that ultimately is safer than where it is today. So
we have a meeting coming up, hopefully.
So hopefully, I mean, I think you've taken a lot of Craig's time on this issue. He has been a point in many ways on this, but I think you'll find out that this is an issue that doesn't just touch Craig's division. It touches highway. It touches the maintenance and operations side of the organization. And I think, as Representative Krieger pointed out, I'm giving some direction that I want some things to change. I think things are changing. We still have a ways to go, but I think I would like to, frankly, take some additional time on this specific topic, if that's one you'd like, to give you where we're going in those various areas.
I think on the 7th and 8th, we have public testimony scheduled. it would be great to have Craig there to deal with this, and also if you could, Director, let me just test the water to see if there is change. You remember last session when we took the committee and we went down to Eugene, and our first stop was at that northernmost exit in Eugene, and that whole what I understand is the most heavily used rest stop area, but exit area for facilities from restaurants and motels and service type things, and any of you that were there or saw that hearing, have we done anything to help those folks? Because I didn't hear a single person there that thought that plan was rational. Everyone realized it was destruction of that area. Had county commissioners, former state senator Bill DeWire, talking about the fact that, well, if we did this and this and this, it would work. Anyone looked at that, Bill's plan and then some of the other folks over there said, yeah, that would work. This plan wouldn't work. What's happened with that process? Because that will kind of give me an indication of how we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, again, Bruce Warner, I can give you also a report. I believe that we have worked with the property owners, the cities in that area, and come up with a plan that is acceptable to all, and we're moving forward with the option of that plan to move that project forward. Clearly, there's an example of an interchange which is overloaded now, and as a result of the intense development, we want to make sure that, again, it continues to function in the next 20 years safely and efficiently, and I think we've come up with a plan that is acceptable to all, at least. That's the least of my understanding. That's so, in fact, we'd be glad to send you a copy of the plan if you'd like to see that.
Great, thanks. Oh, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Senator Dukes, I think you raised some very, very good points. We all have our constituents that are struggling with this issue. I stayed quiet on mine. But you raised a point that I think has merit, and I'd be interested in having an answer to a particular question. How much money are we spending to have the Attorney General deal with legal issues as it relates to small business owners who are contacting attorneys and sending in letters or taking action to try and protect their access? And maybe I'm not phrasing the question as well as I mean to. I've received letters from my folks saying we're hiring an attorney. I'd just be interested in knowing what it's costing the state of Oregon to represent the state's interests against these small business owners.
I can answer the question in part now, but it probably is going to take some follow-up action to do that. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, in this particular part of the budget, that is the portion dealing with the technical assistance and coordination portion of our budget, that represents about $28,000. However, that does not will not fully represent some of the case-specific examples that you're making reference to. We're changing some of the detail about how we capture the costs related to the AG's participation with us in those particular kinds of cases, and we can try and give you a little bit more accurate portrayal of those particular aspects of the cases.
But what I would just point out, Chair, is it's, you know, in order to get our arms around this issue, I think one of the things we have to do is take care of the legal aspects of it. And our small business owners don't have the ability with an open checkbook to go out and to defend themselves, where the state of Oregon, for all points and purposes, does. And so I'm of the opinion that's where you attack this issue.
Representative Hanson.
Well, just a quick comment. One of the things that you figure out as a state representative or a senator after a while, we seldom get the phone calls from the people where the system worked just perfectly. I don't care whether that's nobody's ever called me and said, you know, I went over and applied for food stamps this morning, and gee, I was in and out in 20 minutes. We've hammered you pretty good, but sometimes because our view is, we get really impacted by the people that have problems, and we don't hear too much of the successes sometimes. But just a comment.
Craig, I want you to understand the hammering part. I mean, our constituents feel like they've been hammered, and when you've been put out of business or you've lost access to your property and your value is zero, and that's what you were planning on retirement for, that's a person who's been hammered, and they've been hammered hard. So, you know, we're going to have to get to the bottom of this relative to what's happening, because, as I said earlier, we thought we had a direction that was going to provide management, was going to provide safety. It's turned out to be something completely different from that, and I don't think my opinions about it are unusual. I think we'll hear that from folks who believe that there needs to be reform, and particularly in a time when our economy is in the tank and I expect it to get worse, and yet we provide a discouraging environment. So with that final comment, I'll let you proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I'm going to turn the page.
Okay. How far can we get away from that accent?
Between your half an hour, that's the first time we've been there.
I'm on, now on page 109. I wanted to talk a little bit around the technology transfer. This is an effort that we do jointly with local government. And we used training capacities within our department to share technology issues with the local government in order that their practices can work effectively, and they can, in a sense, adapt and use best practices from the state. The third major area of our budget has to do with analysis and research. This involves our work on behalf of the transportation management systems. I know that you've heard in prior discussions and other committee meetings about, for example, the bridge management system, which evaluates the status of our bridge inventory, of the pavement management system, and similar management systems are applied to other parts of our transportation system. What we glean from those things then is a basis for decision making about where to best apply our resources and how to make them applied in the most cost-effective way, or the areas that can be aimed to seriously resolve transportation questions that are before us. We also do transportation data and mapping. This is a capacity to be able to represent these system conditions in specific areas of the state, be able to know where we're having safety problems, where we're having particular crash statistics of a particular type. This is where we collect that kind of data. We also support work on page 110, talking about the statewide transportation modeling work that we do. This helps us in meeting the requirements of conformity with respect to our air quality obligations. It also is jointly managed with our metropolitan planning organizations in the state, and we do specific work around particular models in the smaller communities as well. We just recently finished setting forth the standards, for example, in Woodburn for a transportation modeling exercise specific to that particular community. Illustrative of this area of work is some work that we did with South Medford Interchange. And we actually, that particular project began with a series of public workshops. We then explored 22 different arrays of solutions to try and figure out which of those would work to solve the problems at that South Medford Interchange. These suggestions came from local government, they came from citizens in the area, and we explored in some detail how we might be able to more effectively handle the transportation problems that we had at that particular interchange and do them in a way that supports the land use proposals that people were having in the Medford urban area. Obviously, we've been able to get to an answer there, and we're beginning to move the project forward in that particular case. But that's the kind of work that we do through our transportation planning analysis group. On page 111, we talk a little bit around some of the other kinds of research projects that we do. We have a couple of projects I'd illustrate here for some examples of what we've been able to accomplish. We have worked on in a way that's working with some other state agencies, some other state DOTs around issues of rockfall and dealing with the height and the slope and the character of the catchment areas below those rockfalls, so that
that we can make sure that there are, that the construction activities that we undertake work in a safe manner. We're also working with Oregon State University to try and look at the cracked bridges problem and do specific analysis around the character of the structures that we have in those cracked bridges to try and replicate through the introduction of cracks and the methodologies we're looking at the way the rebar and the concrete mixes were done originally with respect to those particular bridges, and to try and then look at the various loading issues that relate to those bridges and see if we can't make a better predictive model and make sure the actions that we're undertaking on behalf of the department's work on behalf of the crack bridge problem is done the most effective way. We are also monitoring bridges in place and making sure that we're able to also pay attention to the particular characteristics of how those cracks are actually performing in the field. So those are examples of the kinds of work that we do in the research area of our program. The final area...
Do you do the comparative cost on the method of construction? Because that's a complaint that I've heard from folks, that we seem to use the most expensive method, which may not be technically and engineering-wise the strongest structure, and particularly... As I said earlier, there is the most expensive structure. Do you look at those kind of issues to make sure, in other words, if you can do five bridges for the price of three that we're doing now, I mean, we need to be thinking that way.
Mr. Chairman, we do attack the question from that vantage point. And in fact, we have worked, for example, with Federal Highway in order to cover a particular issue that we were being, in a sense, compelled by the nature of the federal standards that were in place to do more paving and more work on shoulders in areas that we found we had not had any particular consequent crash data or anything else that would suggest that we were really solving a problem. So through our work on PAVE mainly, we were able to deal with, in a sense, narrowing up the obligations with respect to the improvements that we're making and be more cost-effective in the pavement and shoulder handling issues that we had in those particular cases. That's an example of the kind of things that we're trying to do. I'm sure John Rosenberg could speak more extensively around work we have done with respect to design build and other kinds of techniques we're trying to use in order to make sure that our work on behalf of the construction side of the things that we do is done in the most cost-effective way possible. The final area for our particular area of the budget deals with the statewide transportation improvement program, or the often referenced as STIP. Federal regulations require us to have a STIP and set forward an update cycle. We are involved in the budget here supports the work we do on behalf of scoping those particular projects, identifying how the projects are being advanced. We're trying to tie our work that is the planning side of the organization to STIP delivery so that we can shorten the period of time between when a project is envisioned and when it's constructed. This has been an area of vigorous complaint, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that we are doing the best job to stage the consideration of the project in the early stages, to complete as much of the environmental work as we can, so that the continuity between the decision to construct and the final construction of the project is executed in the most time-efficient and most cost-effective way.
Senator Carter.
Okay, Chris, can you tell me, under your STIP agreement with the federal government, who are the stakeholders?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, this has been an area that we have worked on quite extensively over this last biennium. We have created a STIP stakeholder committee, which is broadly representative of all of the interests that we have. I can give you a full membership of that committee if you'd like, but it's a very broad-based committee representing local government, our ACT participants, metropolitan planning organizations, transit interests, environmental interests, and so on, to try and make sure that we were extensive in the outreach we had. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the process for decisions that encompass this STIP are as visible and transparent inside the agency's practice as we possibly can. Indication of some of the improvements we've made are, if you look at the contrast between our last STIP cycle and the 2004-07 STIP, which will be going to the Commission later this year for adoption, the public participation was double from the last STIP cycle. So the one immediate prior STIP compared to the one we're just now going through in draft form had more participation by twice than the previous cycle of the STIP.
Certainly. Are there ordinary citizens on this advisory committee?
They are more interest group based than they are individual citizens. However, the ACT is aimed to be very inclusive, and the guidelines that we have developed for the Area Commissions on Transportation suggest that we're aiming to have about 50% elected representatives on the ACT, and we're trying to have a more balanced, more citizen-based participation on the remainder of the composition of those acts. So we are trying to extend opportunities for citizens to be directly involved in advising the commission about which projects should be selected.
May I strongly encourage, Bruce, that in any of the advisory committees that you just have citizens who have nothing to do with the area. I think government, all of us, even in this political process, we tend to get like minds, and sometimes the best indicator of successfulness in terms of performance measures as well as performance objectives. Now, you can show me measurements all day long. I want to see some objectives. And I think that sometimes having just the ordinary citizen a part of it sometimes give you guys some insight, because you're listening to other governments and other people of interest like we tend to do, and then the government beat the hell out of us because we don't have fresh insight and don't have people who are not connected. So, and I'm only thinking about this, Craig, because this morning Representative Hanson was right. We gave you a tough time today. And sometimes if you can refer back to the citizen members of your advisory committee and say to us, you know, my citizens members, and this is the thing we're listening to, have said thus and so, and we're going to tend to back off a little bit if you've had that. But if you have some other government and some bureaucratic folk coming in, I'm going to question that. But so sometimes let me encourage you to have citizens who are not connected to transportation modes at all to come in. And sometimes we don't use, one of the things we don't use a lot in government is that we have other people in academia who could serve well on advisory committees and give some insight, but we tend not to use it. So next time you have a little buffer. Thank you.
He's fine. He's a big guy.
He is. I support us giving them that. They need this input. They don't have this from anybody else.
Page 111, our research project, right above the statewide STIP analysis. It's an interesting statement, the last sentence. In the climate of scarce resource, research and development becomes extremely important in helping ODOT to work smarter and make more efficient and effective use of the resources available. Now, I wanted to have you go with me just south of Willamette Vineyards, and we're on the way to Albany. And we have a highway that needs to be an additional two lanes added to it. It's four lanes now. It needs to be six, just like it is between Salem and Portland. We have a project that's been going on for a number of years, because I can remember talking with Director Krennican about this. We have basically, particularly as you approach a rest stop out there, you're going to see at least four additional lanes that are out there. Now, if I were planning smart and I was planning efficient, I would be thinking about the resource that's there. In other words, there's no reason that we couldn't have gone inside and built additional car-only lanes, which is happening on the East Coast, so I know the feds have got to be happy with it. You know, in other words, you can use lighter construction methods. Those are your temporary bypass. That becomes permanent lane in the future. Are we thinking about those sort of things? How to maximize that? Because now help me with this, and it'll help me understand where we are. My understanding was we were going to dig all that up and haul it away in the near future when those projects are done. Are we thinking about maximizing those resources? There's a lot of them out there on that section of the highway.
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak specifically to that example. I'm sure by the time John Rosenberger's here, he can answer the question more directly than I can at the moment. One of the sources of difficulty for that particular project was the fund source that was originally relied upon for the interstate maintenance and the capacity enhancing features, which we were in some contest with the Federal Highway Administration about, was whether or not we could leave those particular features of the highway in place. But I'm sure that John can cover that specifically, where that effort or understanding sits at the moment. I can't answer the question out of what I know right now.
We have been pretty rough on Craig for the day, and I'm going to go ahead and end this hearing right now. I want to invite you back for another one.
Thank you.
And so, yes, Senator Morris.
Just one thing, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, too? We can stay here.
Yeah, just from a comparative standpoint, and this may be an attaboy for you. But my earlier question with respect to administrative costs in the motor carrier division, 7 FTEs, a cost of $161,000 per FTE per year. Your administrative costs are $100,000 per year. Those are the kind of questions that I wonder about. You have low FTEs, presumably similar kinds of administrative duties. Why do we have such huge discrepancies? So if you're at $100,000 per FTE per year, maybe that's an attaboy for today.
Well, let's get an answer for that. Maybe
tomorrow.
Thank you. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, everyone. With that, we'll be adjourned.